What's up, everybody? This is Maker Stories, episode 2. Thank you to everyone who listened to episode 1 with Alex Bloomberg and the Gimlet Media team. Before we start, we got some news. We're launching a book club. That's right, a book club. We're going to pick a book a month and have an AMA with the author. The first book is going to be Eric Ries's new book, The Leader's Guide. He's going to launch an exclusive excerpt on Product Hunt. That's right, excerpt. It's not going to be the whole book. Why is it not going to be the whole book? One, because the book's not out yet. Two, more importantly, because every book club I've ever been in has died even before it started. It's like in basketball when you're shooting for teams, right? And people want to shoot from the three-point line. No one makes it, okay? You're just there for like 20 minutes before the game starts. No, you gotta start small. Shoot free throws, you know, one step at a time. You might be saying, hey, Eric, I don't want to join an excerpt club. I want to join a book club. Well, all right. What book should we read next? 0 to 1? Hard Thing About Hard Things? I don't know. You tell me. Tweet me. Tweet me your recommendations. It doesn't have to be tech either. It can be history, science, a novel. Look at that. We can read whatever we want. All right, that's the book club. Book club. We're at Maker Stories now. This is the podcast. And but in honor of the book club, we have a very special guest today, Aaron Lammer from Longform. Aaron's one of the few people who really get tech, but also have literary taste, and he's trying to merge the two. This episode is about books, journalism, the future of content, and how tech affects all this. I'm joined by my friend Libby. All right, here is Aaron.
Hey, on the Product Hunt podcast today, we have me, Eric Torenberg, we have my friend Libby Ashton, and we have my other friend, Aaron Lammer.
Hey.
Hey.
Libby, do you want to introduce yourself real quickly?
I think you did a great job.
Yeah. Sure. Libby is my friend from college who is just a fantastic conversationalist, and I thought would be an awesome compliment.
Thank you.
Wait, you didn't tell me I was going to be on the show with a fantastic conversationalist.
Yeah, absolutely. No pressure. And we're here with Aaron Lammer from Longform.
Hey, we're in my office.
Yeah, we are in Dumbo.
Dumbo. You're at the home of the Longform podcast.
Absolutely.
Which Eric is a very dedicated listener to. I know you're, like, a lot of people say that they're listeners to it, and then I probe them, and they've heard like one episode. You're a you're kind of a stan.
Yeah, that's a nice plug for the podcast.
Yes.
So early in the podcast.
There's going to be more of that coming.
Yeah. I've listened to maybe half or a third.
Yeah.
I curate lists all day, so I can listen to podcasts in the background.
Interesting.
I think when we were first getting to know each other, just a binge of long form, you know, listening to different journalists.
I have a question about that. Do you feel like that's warping your brain? You're doing one thing, listening to something else.
Do you mean, am I getting distracted or?
Yeah. And like, do you feel like I guess I wonder, like, once I've embraced that stuff enough, sometimes I wonder like whether like I'm shifting like my entire attention process.
Maybe. I do realize it's difficult for me to sit down and like write something really, really that requires a lot of concentration.
Interesting.
So I'm always distracted.
I'm sorry, I hijacked your podcast. I'm used to hosting.
No.
I'll defer to the conversation.
No, I mean, I do want to talk about what the podcast allows me to do. I'm curious about journalism and about media and content, and you have honest conversations with writers and with editors as if there wasn't an audience almost. And so it allows me to kind of just see what their life is like, what they think about it. My favorite, or one of my favorites, was when someone called themselves a content farmer, and he just referred to himself as that. I found that pretty hilarious.
I do think that that one of the like secrets of podcasts is that like actually talking to almost anyone about their job in enough depth and detail is pretty interesting. I know that sort of runs counter to like cocktail party etiquette,
right.
But yeah. I do think people's jobs are pretty interesting.
Right. Yeah.
So do I. But okay, what I have been struck by in sort of trying to understand you guys at Longform is that you and Max seem like people who are literary and who love to read and who love to talk to people. But you are also running a tech company, which I think would demand an interest in that as a separate entity, as a separate interest.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I generally gravitate towards people in technology who are strongly like interested in something else. Like I have people who are purely interested in like the startup entrepreneurship world. I find fairly boring.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna burn everyone out on this air. No, I mean,
you said me too. That encompasses all of our listeners.
Yeah,
so wait. No, I'm just kidding.
But no, I think it's natural to be. interested in two things in their union. I don't know, like, what did, like, not that I think they've really adhered to it, but like Apple always said sort of the humanities, right? You know, like, we're using technology as like a vessel towards these more classical pursuits.
Right. And I am a beneficiary of that because I get to listen to podcasts and read well-curated content, but I don't have to then spend so much of my life and energy building the platform that does that. And as a person like you, who I think is interested in the humanity aspect of it, to also be dedicating so much time and energy to the building of the platform, that's fascinating to me.
It does often feel like a waste of time.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm getting at.
So as a person who just like QA'd iOS bugs for 4 straight hours before
and
this.
And I just don't know what that means.
Have you found kind of a community within at the intersection of tech and your literary interests?
Well, we share this office. The Atavist is a company we share the office with. There's a magazine called Rose and Kingdom. So I think actually as the next generation of publishers emerges, people who are starting magazines primarily digitally, like you can't really start a magazine right now without a strong interest in technology. You can't really do anything actually from scratch without a certain like interest in technology. So I do think, there's particularly in New York, there's definitely a community of people like that.
Cool. So we're going to get into all this, but let's just back up a little bit. Tell us the story of long form. How it came about.
Yeah.
Where it's going.
So long form really started as a hobby for myself and my co-founder, Max Linsky. New York has like a different reading on phone culture. Mm-hmm. We're from that's our people. You know, people who are listening in New York know that very reasonably you can spend 90 minutes every day, every work day on a train reading, which you can start really plowing through a lot of reading material. And this was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, right? It was right around when the iPad was coming out, and we were both big Instapaper users, and we felt like there was a demand for a service to give people like content to fill up their queues with. So that was like the very, very early V1 WordPress site that I had on a $5 shared hosting, which promptly got like blown out by the second day, and I got like a ridiculous bill for it. And from there, I think everything we've done is built on that idea. So we continue to run a very similar site that posts 4 great pieces of nonfiction every day. It's not algorithmically driven. We have a team of 8 or so editors who work on the site and do really incredible work reading lots of stuff. And we try to keep the site mixed. So it's New Yorker, and then it's like a magazine from Australia that you've never heard of. And then it's the Davidson Law Review. I mean, that's ideally how it operates. It's exposing people to writing from all different corners of the internet. But we've tried to build on that idea and become more from the reading experience. So we've done this podcast where we interview a nonfiction writer every week, not just about like how they write, but like how they live, how they make a living. Really the whole gamut of what it means to be writing online right now.
And you guys both came from writing backgrounds?
I was a book editor, and then I was a ghostwriter for several years, and then I got kind of interested in web development. So
one of the ghostwriting was Drake.
That was a different pursuit. I was actually ghostwriting books. I am also in a band, and it is correct that I have a credit on the first Drake album.
Wow.
But
his music's really good.
But from there, so we started the podcast, and then we launched this app, which is really, I think, the full culmination of our ambitions. We're talking about it right now as a client for the English language. We're seeking to cover all of the articles written in English. You get them in an app. You can follow publishers. You can follow writers. You can follow friends and seeing what they're recommending. It's basically a way to like interface with the entire spectrum of published content all in one place. But for most people, that involves looking at like a most popular, it's like a most emailed list for the entire internet, or we have the same staff picks we have. So for people who don't want to subscribe to 20 magazines or have, you know, 20 magazine apps, it can be like a really like a one-stop place to read smart stuff.
At what point did it evolve from, you know, something you were doing as a side project or something because you enjoyed? You know, when did you start thinking of it as, hey, this is like a tech company and getting into the tech world? And
I think about 2 years in, right when we started thinking about building this app, like we're both very competitive people. Mm-hmm. And so when we started thinking about making an app, I was like, it better be the best fucking app ever. You know, I like it's yeah. not, I didn't want to like have be like one of those guys in the app store with the like blocky HTML yeah. like layout. So, not that our first app was not actually pretty, you know, right. not, it was not the best app, but
by the way, Donald Glover's about to drop an app.
Oh,
and
really?
He wants it to be the Air Jordan of apps.
Wow. That's a high bar.
Yeah.
So at that point, we started thinking, we started working on it full time, and we kind of divided up our responsibilities. So I've really, on the job, learned how to be a product person. Mm-hmm. And my co-founder, Max, has really become like a tech business person, which right. I'll say is the harder of those jobs to embrace. Like, he's the person who makes it possible to do all of these things by selling ads and figuring out like how you make money on this stuff.
But he's a tech business person. You're the content person.
We actually both kind of work on the editorial side, yeah. but he does the business and I do the product.
I think what's interesting, what Libby was alluding to before, is that it seems that there's so few people who both have really good taste for content editorial and then really understand technology
and have a hunger to that would drive the building.
Yeah, maybe that hunger. It's they're, I don't. Are they antithetical? Like, it almost. What do you think about that?
I feel like you're just baiting me to insult your audience over and over and over again. No, I mean, I think that's real. Like I don't know why I keep thinking of like Steve Jobs here, but like I guess Steve Jobs. It's like, yeah, Steve Jobs had kind of like pretty boring taste in music.
Mm-hmm,
like
right.
this is a guy who basically is like, I built this whole company because I like love music arts, and it's like I'm really into the Beatles, and like, you know, like, and I love the Beatles too, yeah. but you don't think of like Steve Jobs as like a guy who's like pushing forward like obscure MP3 yeah. collections. So yeah. I do think that those things have at times been antithetical, but I think it's more that the heavy growth startup culture is that there's all sorts of weird tech art all over the place.
Yeah.
People doing weird shit on the internet. I mean, I feel like the internet is kind of like where all taste emanates from right now. But I think it's often hard to convince people within the investment structure of the technology industry that stuff matters and that there's something you can do that's better than an algorithm. Engineers generally want to find engineering solutions, and engineered solutions don't require taste.
Right.
That's kind of the whole thing is like, what do we need? Like newspaper editors, like why don't we just get an algorithm to tell us what to write about? Like
yeah.
I'm making a joke, but that's actually a very prevalent attitude. And we try and do both. Like I want to be able to have the best algorithm for recommending articles to people and have the best editors and figure out like what product we can make by rolling that all together.
Yeah.
Like when people are taking computer science in college, there's not like taste and like
yeah.
Humanism taught. So yeah, I think it can be a bit rare. I'm a little old too, old enough that my primary experiences with the internet were like kind of before like startup boom
right.
world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a generational and a cultural difference.
I think there are, I guess because tech is becoming more and more pervasive, more and more interesting people. I think within music, for example, the people who like have great taste are also on board.
Yeah.
Yeah. And doing great stuff in tech. But it seems like publishing in books, for example, you know, it seems maybe writers have been kind of the last creative fields to really either embrace it or get with it, not just like platform thinking, but also even just marketing themselves and thinking
Absolutely.
About themselves as a brand. And maybe those things are, you know, are in conflict.
I generally think that like text or reading is like 10 years behind music and movies. Mm-hmm. Like when we were building the app all the time, I would just steal stuff from Spotify or from Hulu Plus interfaces mm-hmm. just because like no one has built a Spotify for reading yet. So there's not really a good interface reference for it, but there's great references in music and video. And I think that it makes sense for writing to follow like a similar course. I don't like know exactly what that means from a business perspective, but it's certainly from a consumer perspective, like feels like it's coming, and the people who exploit it or like
yeah.
work within those confines, I think will do well. It's all the same sort of cliches, like writers are brands, and like people who have big followings command power and can really control their work in ways that people who don't. And I don't feel like all these things don't have consequences. I think there are consequences for these shifts, as there were in music and video, but I'd rather like think we're like out ahead of them a little bit and trying to build something great within that sphere than being like, pull the brakes. This is
yeah.
going to be terrible. it's coming. So like, I hope that we're building something that's both like good for readers and good for writers and publishers.
And by consequences, you mean like quality getting worse?
I mean, there's certainly business models that are being shaken up, and younger people are never going to like subscribe to a print magazine, right? Probably. Yeah. The new world, it's not like exactly clear. Like, it was kind of clear in music. It's like, what we got to do is take all of these albums that we had on CD and we'll digitize them and sell them, and then we'll like stream them. That's not exactly a one-to-one with publishing. Like, the whole thing could change. Like, the content itself could change in a way that I don't really feel like recorded content has changed that much in music. Yeah. Its delivery has changed a lot. And I would certainly hope for a world where the delivery improved a lot, but the content actually remained kind of like timeless and great.
Musicians have realized in the last whatever 5 years or whatever that they've had to talk to their artists, to their fans directly.
Yes.
And manage that process. And it seems that it has been a bit slower for writers to do that, but they're, you know, beginning, especially journalists are certainly, you know, understanding that.
The ideal writers within like our app are people who are like publishing lots of stuff at like tons of different venues, which you're starting to see as like a trend. It's like, oh, I'm writing on Medium, but I also have like a thing on the New Republic, and I also have something on the New Yorker's website. And there's not really like a way to track those people right now, but there's certainly like people like Paul Ford who are just doing really interesting stuff like across a lot of different publishing areas. And you know, I think what we're trying to build is like a tool to like keep connected with those people. But sort of conversely, I think once the tools are there and like that idea is out there, there will be more writers to follow who follow that course and aren't like trying to become a staff writer at the New York Times, but are just trying to do whatever they want, kind of.
They become the stars instead of the brands behind them. What do you think about like the Patreon model? So basically their fan base pays them monthly directly.
Maybe I've been like around too long. Like Flatter was the thing that people were going to do like, I don't know, 5 years ago that was like that. And if you have a job, that's like a fantastic way to like eventually buy a car, maybe. Right. I wouldn't want to pay my rent on tips. I think that there's like a ceiling to the people who want to engage in that kind of business. But I'm always wrong about this kind of shit, so maybe it's going to be huge.
That's interesting. Have you seen Oyster?
I have seen Oyster. Yeah, they've advertised, and I've met with the guys who do it. They're sharp. It's like Netflix for books.
Yeah. $10 a month, and you get unlimited books.
I mean, wow. This podcast, you can just keep lobbing me things, and I'll criticize them. I think Oyster is kind of a good idea. Like, it's a cool idea. Yeah. My question with Oyster is like always going to be, how many books a year do people read to justify like a book reading subscription? I think it's great if you're like power reading. Seems like most people would be like juiced if they finished 10 books a year or whatever, in which case the economics are sort of shakier. But if they can get the whole catalog, I mean, that's definitely something that we've seen with like the Atavist and other people who are doing these kind of Kindle singly releases is, I think from a user experience perspective, people would actually like shorter books. People would like to read more short books. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, like, do you guys watch The Daily Show?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you have like authors on The Daily Show and they come on and they're like, it's like this book, it's like a counterintuitive take on Abraham Lincoln. I'm like, sign me up. I'm going to read it. Sounds great. You know, and then it's like the next night, the same thing. It's like, I probably will read one book a year based on someone being on The Daily Show. I watch every night. And I wonder like if those books were like something I could read in an evening, how many more of them I would read.
Totally.
That's something the publishing industry has never really reckoned with. Like the idea of like, what's the product people want? Let's make it. Not like, here's our product. Do you want it?
Right.
And I think that those things are coming. And then something like Oyster, I think, is very well situated as a one-stop shop for that kind of stuff if it were to make that move.
One of the reasons I brought up Oyster is because I just met them last week.
Yeah.
In Las Vegas at a conference.
You got a crazy life.
at a conference.
In a hot tub?
No. they were presenting. Their big vision was to make reading more popular. That's what they're engaged with. On Product Hunt, we've seen like hundreds of music apps. Everyone wants to make like a music discovery. Like, you know, follow your fans as an artist. Like, everyone's making music apps.
Yep.
I can count maybe on one hand the amount of book-related app. Like, no one is working on book related stuff. I don't know if it's because people in tech don't read or yeah. aren't interested in reading. You know, everyone listens to music, but Amazon bought Goodreads for like a good amount of money.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah. And Goodreads is yeah. I don't know, it's Goodreads.
I mean, we were out doing some pitches in San Francisco. We're trying to raise some money right now to expand, and no one said, wow, someone came in with the same idea as you.
Yeah.
Like, I've never heard anything like that. In fact, like, I've never even heard, like, I'm getting lots of ideas in the same space.
Right.
It's underutilized, which is interesting because when you look at Amazon, which is a giant company,
yeah.
they built that whole company on top of books. The thing that lured all those people in was books.
Right.
That's how they sold the toilet paper.
Yeah.
Like, the toilet paper was like, people who came looking for books and got offered toilet paper and home electronics and mm-hmm. all this other stuff. So you kind of would think like maybe books are like a beacon that would pull yeah. people in. But I mean, to me, it seems like an opportunity. Like, well, you asked me like why we got involved yeah. in wanting to be in technology is like, I feel like we can be on the front page of people's phones. Like there isn't that strong competition. Like everyone uses Netflix. Everyone uses Spotify.
Right.
If you go ask 10 people how they primarily read, you'll get 10 totally varied responses from, I think the majority of people read in Safari or
yeah.
Android Safari.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, I don't think people know what they're doing. I think that it's like a wide open place right now. And you know, I think the fact that the industry, the money sort of flowing out of the industry rather than into the industry makes it like kind of a weird bet for some people.
Yeah.
But I think attention, when you look at people's attention and what people do on a phone, people generally studies cite three things. It's like listening to music, reading, and watching video. Two of those things are claimed. One of them is just like wide open canvas right now. So that's why I think it's exciting.
I just wanted to share my experience of long form thus far.
Thank you.
Which
testify.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. I teach in Brooklyn, and I get to school really early.
Are we gonna get to talk about your job at some point?
We can go wherever we want to go.
Okay.
Okay.
But
great.
First,
I'm just gonna tell you about this.
First, flatter me a little bit.
Yeah. Okay.
Great.
Okay. I get there early, and there's like a 30-minute window before kids get there. So in that time is when I end up just opening things. That's when I read.
Mm-hmm.
So my browser window is always filled with like 15 different articles that I have opened because people have emailed them to me or people shared things on Facebook that seemed interesting.
Pesky tabs.
Right. So many pesky tabs. And I have no idea which article to prioritize. They all seem interesting. And I went to long form and just decided to close all of the other browser windows and just read what you guys gave me. And I was able to get through like 2.5 actual articles instead of reading the first paragraph of 15. Meanwhile, the people who are recommending those other 15, if it's on Facebook, like I have no idea who they are, what their taste is, what their worldview is, the content that they're curating for me, who knows. And so like my day today as a teacher in Brooklyn was different because I read the stuff you guys told me to read and I was able to get through it. It like simplified it. It served me something. So that felt really good from the perspective of me as the individual user. So I guess I'm sort of interested in the way that curators now are actually, it seems like a real social undertaking. There's like a social mission to what you're doing in that if you curate content in a certain way, people are going to understand truth differently.
Thank you. First.
Okay, so you did two things for me today. You like
yes.
made my day better and you like told me what was true, right?
I don't know whether we can tell you what's true. That might be a high bar.
Okay,
but what
that's
I would say is, like, one of our goals is there's going to be 9,000 articles about Ferguson that come out
totally.
This week. So you could read 25 of them. If I can consistently tell you one to read and you have a better experience with that, I think you'll keep coming back. And that's what defines the difference between what we're trying to do and someone who's trying to like flood the Facebook wall with like
right.
links about like celebrities who've hit people with cars
right.
is I know that that's a more addictive behavior. Like, and like, I know that works. Like, I don't deny that all these things work, but I wonder in like 5 or 10 years, if you're going to be like, remember that time when I read that thing about celebrities who have hit people with cars,
yeah.
that was a strange period of my life. But whereas if I can get you to read something, if I can get the best article about Ferguson and I can embed myself in your memory,
right.
when I say I mean the company, not like literally me. But if we can achieve that, I think that would be something that you might want to keep a part of your life for like years, not months or decades. And that's how we're building the company in the same way that people used to subscribe to a magazine.
Yeah.
The part I don't like about subscribing to magazines isn't that I think they're like bad. It's just like, I don't want more shit at my house piling up.
Right.
It's a practical concern.
Right.
I think that like building trust relationships, which is what editors are there for, you're supposed to trust editors, is valuable.
Right.
And it's very flattering to me to hear that you trust our taste. My goal is to like continually make you trust it more,
right,
until I undermine you from within. That's great. I think, will you come along to our pitches? That was like I think you just gave a way better pitch than I did. That was excellent.
So about money, this is truth.
Yeah. No, and when I said you telling me the truth, you making what is true apparent for me, it's not you, it's the people,
it's the writer
who you expose. Yeah. Exactly, it's the writer.
We always want to put the writer at the top of the equation, because writers, you know, if you give me the option of reading like the entire internet's opinion on something versus one great writer, I will take one great writer.
And you're right that there's not an easy way for me to find everything that one great writer has said thus far about Ferguson. And
correct.
So I can't do that.
Correct.
I don't have that. But I have your platform, which, yeah.
So I would hope that like, you know, as this app evolves, you know, you can see different people taking different approaches to the same problem. So you can see like these sort of Flipboardy, like social news aggregators, which are taking a lot of links from Twitter and Facebook, plus some like feeds you can subscribe there, and giving you like sort of a fire hose of the entire. It's like the internet as like in a magazine, but it's the whole internet. And then you can see places like Circa that are heavily editing multiple news sources into one article, which I think is an interesting approach.
And they get really short,
and it goes short, and it's kind of like cliff notes for everything that happened. And then what we're trying to do is say like, we're not going to give you everything, and we're not going to like condense it. We're going to give you one great writer's vision of what's going on. And if you read one thing, hopefully this is the best thing you read. And I think all of those are really like appeal to different people and different personalities and different choices about how you spend your time.
Right.
And what's interesting, you resurface content from the past.
Like, yes.
Eminem just dropped something recently, so I saw this Zadie Smith Eminem art profile from 2005.
Right. I love that you guys do that.
It was amazing.
Well, one of my like really grandiose ambitions for what we're doing that like it does not work in the way I'm describing it, but I want it to. So the archive in the app has about 200,000 articles in it. And I would say probably by the end of 2015, we should have cataloged over 1 million. And those are all tagged, like completely cataloged in a searchable way. So like, I want long form to operate like Wikipedia, where like, if you're interested in a topic, you'll put it in Wikipedia, you can read the Wikipedia page. It's usually kind of dry.
Right.
And like, it's written by multiple sources. Like, maybe it's a great Wikipedia page. Maybe it's like one of those kind of dud Wikipedia pages. I want it to be like, okay, this bombing that took place in Spain in the 80s, I want you to be able to put this search in and get like a writer's like who's written about it.
Right.
Like an actual like a actual reporting on anything.
Right.
Unfortunately, really very little of like pre-2007, really even like pre-2009 back catalogs have been digitized. But I hope that it becomes worthwhile for people to digitize those, so then we can really fill back in all of publishing history, and there's amazing stuff that's not online. So we are doing work where we contact writers and try and license old articles and put that aren't online and put them online. We have like, I don't know, we put up the original Friday Night Lights article this year, and we had like a Lewis Lapham profile of Thelonious Monk from the 60s. Mm-hmm. But those are just kind of fun. I mean,
I hear a similar kind of explanation for what companies are trying to do. Like, be better than Google in some ways, or different in that, you know, people are looking to learn about a topic. Mm-hmm. You can go to Google, you can Wikipedia. There are a few different one, Quora.
Yep.
They're trying to be kind of a knowledge platform through
Q&A,
and I think they're great. Another is Rap Genius through annotation. So I guess your text could exist and, you know, other people could annotate it. And it's interesting to think a lot of different companies are thinking about, but how people will kind of like pass knowledge and how they will learn and how they will study. You're taking the article approach. They'll want to read, you know, really great articles.
That's a great encapsulation. That's dead accurate. Like, I look at the article as like a content type.
Yeah.
Like, there's like the MP3, the song is like a content type, and the video is like a content type. There's a few video types. There's like the feature movie.
Right.
There's like the 2-minute funny video. Mm-hmm. And I think the article, like, I don't like the word long form. If we could change the name, I would change the, it's not like length has nothing really to do about it. You can tell what's an article and what's not an article. Mm-hmm. An article is a distinct content type. A listicle is not an article.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A like blog post that's just a like sort of a summation of an article is not an article. An article is like a distinct content type, and I think that they should be treated as such. And there's so much amazing stuff to do with the article as a content type in terms of human knowledge.
I have to think that a lot of Goodreads value and why they got sold is because of the conversation they had around and all the data they had around books and how people were
absolutely
liking the books and how they were engaging with the books, and that kind of serves as a piece of history. So I wonder if, you know, people will talk about and engage with past articles in the same way.
I think so. When you can learn a lot from someone based on what they read, which is why I think like our company ultimately does have a lot of value, and I will continue to pursue it as such. Like when you look at like the publishing industry, you go into a airport, you go in there and you buy a book.
Yeah.
No track of it at all ever. You go on Amazon, buy a book. Amazon knows about it. Publisher never doesn't know about it. There's no way for a publisher to get a list of who bought like a book. So when you write your second book, you're just starting over again, basically. You're
right.
Like, you just have to hope that someone sees that you wrote another book, which is why reviews and like reading tours and all that stuff are really important. Like even in the age where like, oh, all the newspapers going out of business, the publishing industry still considers newspaper reviews to be like a, you know, and all the other kinds of reviews to be really important, because you can't really get the word out otherwise. And then you look at something like Goodreads, where people are voluntarily you know, putting their book taste up, which A, tells you like, here's a list of people who read this person's old book, which is hugely valuable if you're trying to sell another book. And, you know, the publishing industry is not trying to sell like millions and millions of copies. It's trying to sell 20, 100,000 copies. If you can get a list of 50,000 people who read the person's book, it's very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But additionally, you from something like Goodreads, you're getting like a sample of someone's taste. You can say, all right, this person reads sports biographies.
Right.
Let's push that out there. And so we're capturing a lot of the same kinds of data, and I think they'll be very valuable to getting a picture of a lot of readers.
People discuss articles. They share articles.
Absolutely.
But the reason they don't share as much past articles is because there's just Michael Lewis has an article next week. You know, there's just so much volume.
Yeah.
Do you see or have you seen at all like, you know, article clubs, the way there are book clubs talking about past great articles. That
there is one. Max is in one.
Interesting.
There's one that was talked about in the New Yorker, and somehow people got the idea that I am in that club and keep asking me to get introduced to the club, but I'm not in the club. I didn't even know about the club until the New Yorker story, and my co-founder is apparently in the club.
It's official.
So, yeah, the answer is yes. They're out there, but what I'd like to do is bring that sort of book club experience like into like onto the phone.
Right.
Personally, I don't really want to ever go to a book club. It's one of my life ambitions, but I'm into the like discussion part, and I'm into the and I do have an informal loop of people who we do talk about this stuff with. So one of the things we want to build is annotation and highlighting within the articles, so that like instead of sharing with you like a link, I'm sharing like a passage, and then you have a comment on that passage, and I'm commenting on your comment on the passage. I think that book club experience is like very fundamental to like what people enjoy about books, except for books, you only have to go meet once a month. And, you know, what I imagine is with articles, I was saying you can do them a lot more rapidly. So there's actually a lot more material.
I'm just curious, in the way that TED as a platform, they curate content that they think ought to be curated. They invite people to speak who they think have something worth speaking about. And I'd be interested to know if when picking that content, they're thinking about the tastes of the people who are already watching TED videos. But when you pick your content, are you thinking about that? Are you thinking about serving the tastes of the people who are already reading long form? Or are you thinking about what people who are reading long form ought to be reading?
I think we're thinking about their tastes, but we're also thinking about surprising their tastes and pushing back against their tastes.
Still satisfying their tastes?
It's kind of like coming out of the kitchen where you're like, I know you ordered the soup, but like, try the salad.
Yeah.
Well, we did not get to talk about your job. Tell us about what you do.
I teach first grade in Bed-Stuy.
What attracted you to that originally?
Ooh, I am just really compelled by the idea that our system of educating is the thing that's going to most radically change, in addition to digital media, in the next 25, 30 years. And so I just felt that. And I knew that I wanted to be involved in that in some way. And I started kind of getting involved in some startups that were trying to shake things up in education, and then came to feel that I just wanted to see what it was like to be in a school, and I wanted to see what it was like to be in a school that was doing very, very well. And so it by sort of non-traditional means. So I work at a charter school, and it's fascinating.
Are charter schools considered sort of at the forefront of change within schools?
By some people. And I sought out the charter school that I work at because they are a big startup and they are bold in their aspirations, and they're also really rigorous and effective in their execution. So I wanted to go to a place that was like trying to do everything, trying to close the achievement gap, but without sacrificing joy, and was demonstrating that they could do that, that they had the sort of operational capacity to make that happen.
Did you ever consider teaching, Eric?
I did, actually.
We had a big fight about it once.
Yeah.
Wow. Tell me about it.
Our senior year.
You went to college together.
Yes,
both of you. Where was that?
University of Michigan. Libby originally got into Teach for America and rejected it.
Yeah.
And then I got in, and then I deferred it, but I was thinking of accepting it. And I think for similar reasons, was very interested in education, but maybe through different means. I had been involved in a boarding school for athletes, for aspiring athletes, called IMG Academy in Florida, Sarasota. And it was a very amazing experience. And I wanted to work with people who like really wanted to work. Growing up, I didn't have like that inspire. Like I really wanted to like be engaged and wasn't engaged. And I felt I wanted to give that to other people at the time. But then felt that, I mean, TFA would be radically different. You know, people who came from radically different backgrounds than I had. And yeah, I deferred it to do a music tech startup, and here I am. And I eventually do want to get into it in education in some capacity, but there are a few things. One, maybe something like Quora or Genius, some tech, something that engages them in a different way might be what I'm better suited to do.
I thought about being a teacher for a period of my life. I ultimately feel like I'm like kind of too full of shit to be a teacher. Like I'm not. Like, I feel like being a teacher is about, like, constantly when we're working on the site, I'm like, let's just deploy this. People are like, whoa, like, this might catch on fire and, like, the server would go down. I'm like, whatever. And I feel like having that attitude is not good around children. Like, having the, like, it's okay if we, like, take some risks. Like, or, like, you know, like, I lied and cheated my way through my own education. That's not really what you want from the teacher, you know?
Okay, but often people like you make the best teachers because we just know we know what's up. We know how it is
really?
With the kids.
Okay. Yeah, totally. I just feel like I'm a corner cutter.
Yeah.
You know, like I would be like
the best teachers are corner cutters.
Here's what would happen if I was teaching. I would like have all the papers to grade.
Yeah.
I would just be like, I just gonna give them all B pluses. I'm not gonna read
and
all
I'm not gonna do it. Okay, yeah. But that's the fascinating thing about the people who are trying to make the system different is that you can't be effective if you're just gonna. It's all about like netting value in a really efficient way. And so you sound. I mean, corner cutters. They're undersold, really, in pretty much all ways, I think.
There's a lot of high school classes that use like long form as like a teaching thing. Like you have to read a story from long form every week and write something about it. And like we can see them in our analytics. And that's
awesome.
Well, although it is ironically another example of lazy teachers, though.
I'm telling you, lazy teachers are the way of the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I have a few kind of wrap up questions, but they could open more dialogue. What are you going to like, Libby, leave this conversation like not... Like, what's the question you haven't asked yet that you'll be, like, curious about as you leave?
I'm just still stuck on this thing that, like, if the 30 minutes that I spent this morning reading articles that I found by way of long form, if those 30 minutes are the thing that kind of keep me sane through the day.
Yes.
You've turned the thing that keeps you sane into the thing that makes you insane, which is your job.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself in your own version of those 30 minutes reading articles on long form?
part of my conflict here, and I'll be totally honest, is like, so this is like, this is a product hunt thing. And I'm like, part of me wants to be like, everything is great. Give me some money.
No one listens to that.
But honestly, no, I'm like pretty burnt out.
Yeah.
Like I don't really do any. during the period we were making the app, I like herniated a disc and got an ulcer.
Oh, God.
And my co-founder had a baby. Those are not similar things.
But,
I'm sorry for him.
So yeah, it's I don't really feel like I have like I don't go read for pleasure
yeah,
as much
anymore.
I feel like I'm doing my job every time I'm involved with it, which is unfortunate, but it's kind of validating to ruin something you love, you know?
Tell me about that.
Teenage masturbators will know what I'm talking about. like I just it does make me appreciate everything else about life so much. It
Whoa.
Just makes me not appreciate this quite as much as yeah. I once did. And you know, a lot of it's not just like the overflagellation stuff. It's like you get involved in all the like bickering and Twitter commenting and the like, you know, this person raised more money than this person and this person's traffic, you know. It's like every time I see like something what has startup has nothing to do with what we're doing, and it's like they raised this money and they have 40 million uniques, I'm like, why don't I have 40, like, you know, it's just
yeah.
like competition drives and ruins the
yeah.
world. And I guess I find it validating because I think it's good to hit the point where you realize that about things where you're like, oh, at its core, like everything is competitive and like
yeah.
that kind of ruins everything, but it's also what makes the world great.
Right.
And I wouldn't have any other way. How about you? Has teaching ruined teaching for you?
One of the things that I think drove me to teach is that thinking and talking and writing and ideating around education became so deadening to me, and it like just abstracted it all to the point of nothingness, and it like I needed ground badly. And so I always say that I'm just in this like period now where I'm so action oriented and I'm not at all strategizing in any kind of like conceptual high level way. I'm strategizing constantly in a really active way. Like
yeah.
I'm playing a game and I'm in the middle of the game for 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. So I think I did it. I think I'm teaching because of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it terrified me the way that I was feeling the light sucked from like the thing that was the most interesting and felt singularly compelling as a way to spend my professional life. So I like felt desperately like I needed to do something to stop that from happening.
Yeah.
And teaching right now is totally doing that. Like every day there's something new and fascinating and relevant.
So I think you should do radio. Have you thought about doing a podcast show?
I felt very nervous this whole time.
Is there like what do teachers listen to? Like what is media for teachers
okay,
about
so
your job? Do you have like
I don't know, because here's my other thing with podcasts is that there's so many and
yep.
there's so it's the same thing. Like I need somebody to now curate podcasts for me. You have a podcast at Longform, which I like and
yep.
have listened to.
Yeah, we're planning to do Longform FM and Longform TV, which will be like curated audio and video
oh my God.
In the next couple of years. So.
Yeah, I might need only one browser window, which is Longform.
Well, I think podcasts are actually interesting from a media perspective because I have podcasts I listen to like every single one. There's only a few of them though, like that. But what I don't hear are like the one-off like people don't recommend like an episode to you generally. They recommend a podcast, which is like a huge undertaking where
yeah.
you're like, oh, there's 200 episodes.
Yeah.
I'm going to listen to all these. So like, I think that there's a market for bringing audio to a more article level
yeah.
experience where it's actually just a single like shareable story or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like BBC does amazing stuff you never hear. Like
right.
just because audio doesn't really get shared that way right now, but I hope we can change that.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, Eric.
Go for it.
How long has Product Hunt existed?
About a year.
A year? Okay. So I've been doing this for 4.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, everything just feels so like fresh. Like every morning I get the Product Hunt email and it's like, oh, this and this. Like people are doing all kinds of stuff. Like really, it feels very vibrant. Like it feels like, wow, like look at all these people just doing projects, like from the like gazillion dollar like hardware product packs to like the ones that are like funny jokey, you know, like
right.
one off, like
yeah.
spend 5 minutes doing something.
Like yo.
Yeah. No, but there's like even
yeah.
ones that are
yeah.
just more like just like sort of experiments. They're not
yeah.
really like going anywhere.
Right.
What do you think it's going to feel like? Like looking back in a few years, let's say 4 years down the line, you're going to be able to scroll back in Product Hunt and it's going to be a graveyard. Almost none of that shit will exist. And I don't just mean like most of the companies will have gone out of business. I also mean even those experimental little jokey projects, someone's not going to pay their DNS bill and that's just going to be gone. And I can tell you this because like our links are dying all the time. You know, it's like, do you think about like the flip side, like the fact that all this is so transitory and that it's like a lot of cheerleading, but it's like very little is going to survive?
I haven't thought about that. I mean, I think that's in every genre. Like, I think, you know, a lot of things are going to be made and some are going to be timeless. And most of them aren't, whether it's books or music or... I think starting companies and killing companies and, you know, starting other ones, and I think that's just part of the game.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, to reframe the question slightly, and that's an interesting response, you know, there's this idea that startups and companies and these ideas are a form of art. And I don't think that's either... I don't think that's true and I don't think that's false. I think that's like about who you are and how you view the world. But if I go make a album in my basement and hardly anyone listens to it and like someone to put it up on Spotify,
right?
In 20 or 30 years, someone's going to be able to find that and listen to it. And that's a lot of the way I listen to music, like really incredible, like private press records from the 70s are on YouTube now. You can listen to them. They lived. Like, the people die, but they lived.
Right.
But the part where that sort of metaphor, or it's not really a metaphor, the idea that startups are art, or that these businesses are like, they're the new artists, the part where that breaks down is that the things they're making
don't have
no permanence to them. They're not even properly really archived. Like, you see the Jason Scott, like, text file stuff. He's just working to, like, preserve the internet. The internet is constantly overwriting itself, and everything sort of hurtling towards, like, death or, like, IPO. But even IPO, you know, doesn't mean that things are maintained. So I guess I just wonder how the people like you who are working within, seeing tons and tons of startups. And I know that for you, you have a human connection. You're going around and meeting all these people. You're going to meet all these people like at the time when they like were believing in this one thing. And then most of them are going to have to like bury it.
I guess I don't know enough about archiving to, like, for example, I buried RapidFM as a company, but to me it was a music tech startup.
Yeah.
It's still like people still go on and rap on it. Like it's still an art project and we're paying its bills and we're hoping to keep it up forever. I would question if business people are starting to see themselves more as artists, which I believe is true. You know, everyone's got a portfolio. They're like saving their projects. If they think that their projects are going to last, if they're, you know, working to archive, if they're not, so I don't know whether they are or not. Mm. And two, if they aren't, I haven't thought about that, but that's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't necessarily, it's maybe one of the things that makes it exciting is that the slate keeps getting wiped clear and that we're not living in the past. Like, it is amazing when you step outside technology into like industries that have not been changed by technology, how old they feel. Like, I always get on a plane. Whenever I get on a plane, I'm like, man, this plane seems so old. Like, remember when do you remember when JetBlue started?
Yeah.
I remember like I first flew to Joe, I was like, this plane's from the future. Like, this plane's amazing. And now I fly JetBlue, I'm like, old ass airplane.
Yeah. This episode isn't going to have a ton of listeners, but the people who do listen are going to love it.
Great.
And if you're hearing this and you love it, tweet at us.
Tweet.
And let us know.
At Longform.
Yeah,
at
absolutely.
Aaron Lyron.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you at, Libby?
I'm at Lib Ashton, which...
At Lib Ashton.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm Eric Thornburg.
Eric Thornburg.
I think if you take the view that products have value in their own... value in themselves, which as just being a relic of the creative energy and capacity of the people who make them, then what you're saying, Eric, is true and holds and makes sense, which is that it's just... this beautiful spring that dries up and springs and dries up and whatever. But if you take the view that products have value because of the function they serve or the value they have to users, then when users are no longer able to use them or when they no longer serve a function, they're wasted. And what value do they have even as like a memory or something? And I think, Eric, you really sort of advocate for the idea that making businesses just for its own sake of the making is... valuable.
So we had like a 4-hour, you know, argument over this. You know, sometimes you argue a stance and then the other person kind of, you know, I was conflicted after the argument. So there's a difference between making businesses and making products. I think, you know, hackathons as jam sessions, I'm all for. You know, the people that you can make a product just because you want to, you know, you think it's beautiful or you want to learn engineering and people can benefit from that. I think that's awesome. I'm conflicted to the point where something becomes like a business, especially a scalable business, you know, how it retains its artistic upbringings. But yeah, I think what you said is totally. Yeah.
It's funny what you say about like the regrets of the fact that we've taken this idea somewhat far and are like lop off. One of my great regrets is like now I have all these other cool ideas that I actually know how to do it now. I've got like a great iOS developer sitting next to me. We got a bunch of servers running and I'm like, you guys, I just thought of it. Everyone's like, fuck you.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah.
People who are working 12-hour days are not receptive to your hackathon side project idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I often think that like incubators have like the wrong idea, like signing up like teams of people who already have an idea.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I think incubators would actually be better served to get interesting people in one place, like get like designers programs and like have them like build from there.
Mm-hmm.
Like you get weirdly like people who are this like Dumbo is like tech incubator ground zero here.
Yeah.
So I like hear a lot about and it's usually people who are coming in with this idea that they've been like thinking on for years and years and years, and it's all like pent up, and it's like that's actually not a great
idea.
Place to start. Like I really like if I was going to say anything to people who like want to do like projects that they care about regardless of whether they're startups or whatever, it's like it's so much better to like start from like a thing you made one afternoon and that to like build than to like build up something huge in your mind and like get into like an incubator, and then it's like it's very hard to do that, and it I think it works against people's like creative energy when you get kind of so far away from what you're actually going to be able to make at like 3-month tech incubator.
Yeah.
You guys are both fans of George Saunders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and he was on that was a great podcast episode.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested in or invested in this idea of like role models and their effect on society and the idea that one, let's just say Miley Cyrus, Justin Bieber, let's just say like this popular people that everyone looks up to or kids and emulate and aspire to be, and the untold externalities that has on society as a whole. I think that's very big, not to get into that for a second. But some people think it's an issue, like tech is becoming very, very cool, or air quotes around cool. But a lot of these celebrities are now...
He didn't actually do air quotes.
a lot of these celebrities are now frolicking around tech people. So I think it's like a major step up that like Andreessen or Zuckerberg have now become celebrities.
Yeah.
Or Steve Jobs, let's just say, has become like an icon.
Yeah.
And, you know, countless kids have gotten into programming and developing because of that. Why can't George Saunders also be like a huge... Most people don't know who George Saunders is, but if you do know George Saunders, you think he's like one of the most impressive and loving and caring people, you know, there is. I want to see that type of change that, you know, that artists who have... values that should be emulated become insanely popular. But it almost seems that what makes someone insanely popular is like you have to, I don't know, sacrifice some of those things sometimes.
Well, I mean, if you go to like an MFA program in Iowa, you'll find some people who are very interested in George Saunders.
Like, yeah, exactly.
It's kind of like, it's partially like, you know, who you hang out with, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But why isn't it more mainstream?
Yeah, there's certainly something to be said for like the idea that George Saunders is like a breakout short story writer, and I don't know, he's still selling probably under a million copies, whereas like the Vice Dispatch from Ferguson will probably get a million views in its first day, or Paul Graham appearing at like Stanford Startup 101 will get millions of views. So I think there's an element to get rich quick and self-help have been selling for 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the technology industry has very effectively swallowed both of them into what it sells people and delivers people too. And I think that someone like George Saunders can't sell all the same goods. Like George Saunders also gets like outsold by diet books. There are certain human impulses that are popular in different ways, but at the same time, I don't think we need to cry for George Saunders. I think the people who've read George Saunders and really appreciate his work are having a more profound experience with his writing. And like things don't have like a like incrementing counter on the side of them by which they are judged. Like history is pretty clear on that one. The things that people are making money on now and buying and selling right now are not like the ultimate arbiter of their value.
Right.
we're not like talking about like American like lumber comedies of the 1800s. No one remembers them. They made billions of dollars in 1800 currency, mm-hmm. building the railroads, made millions of dollars, and was like what you did if you wanted to like get the nice suit and put on your tie and like have the nice house in New York City in the 1800s, but you didn't. Those aren't necessarily things that endure. So I do think that there's different scales for them. To take this to a more product view and less of a depressing worldview, I do also think that there's like great strides that can be made around writing and reading. Like I think that part of the reason that this stuff still feels kind of like it's lagging behind is because there aren't like people who are like injecting it with like the same juice that like something like the music industry has. And that's certainly something I'd like to change. I don't think it'll happen overnight, but I do think that like all these people who are coming with these like music startups to Product Hunt, right? Like they're all basically engineers who are trying to pair your taste up with like using some sort of an analysis, right? Almost all music is on some version of the idea that like, I'm going to tell you music that you haven't heard that you're going to like. Not only do I think that like writing and reading haven't had that period, I think that's like too dumb for the right. what's going on there. And there will be like more intelligent ways that spread writing all over the world.
Cool. On that note, I think this was a fantastic conversation.
Thank you, Libby. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah. You think we're a good team?
I think so. I'm looking forward to Libby's Teachers on Teachers. Yeah.